Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The world is on course to register the fastest growth in 50 years after the pandemic-induced downturn, but only the wealthiest countries stand to benefit, UN economists said on Wednesday. A new report from the UN Trade and Development Body, UNCTAD, maintained that this partial rebound happened because wealthy countries have spent their way out of trouble. But this has not been possible for poorer nations, whose economies have been hit much harder by COVID-19 than the 2008-09 financial crisis, said UNCTAD Secretary General Rebecca Greenspan.
We are seeing now extremely accommodative monetary policies and huge fiscal packages utilized by countries with currencies reserve status. In the meantime, developing regions whose spending packages were but a fraction are already having to cut back some of their spending and increase their interest rates in reaction to the fears of increasing inflation, increasing debt ratios, and the prospect of a new adverse cycle in financial markets.
The UNCTAD chief highlighted that global economic growth was likely to be highly uneven and that next year it is likely to slow significantly, with incomes trailing 3.7% below pre-pandemic levels. The Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, Amina Mohammed, has condemned a suicide bomb attack in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. Tuesday's attack, which killed at least 9 people and injured several others, reportedly happened outside a tea shop. Responsibility has been claimed by terrorist group Al-Shabaab. It comes after Ms. Mohammed's visit to the country at the weekend, which coincided with parliamentary elections. In a tweet on Wednesday, the Deputy Secretary General said that she was deeply saddened to learn of the deaths and injuries. The Deputy UN Chief also repeated that the UN stands in solidarity with Somalia and remains ready to support the Somali people and government in its pursuit of peace and development. Casualties caused by cluster munitions increased in 2020, despite progress in efforts to eliminate these weapons, a UN-backed civil society report said on Wednesday. The Cluster Munition Monitor 2021 recorded at least 360 casualties globally last year, although it said the true number is likely much higher. Civilians have been the primary victims, with children representing nearly half or 44% of all casualties, and women and girls around a quarter. The report found that efforts to eliminate and stigmatize these weapons through the International Ban Treaty continue apace, despite the dislocation and upheavals brought about by the COVID-19 pandemic. The widespread condemnation of denials by Azerbaijan that it had used cluster munitions in the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict shows how the prohibition on these weapons is gaining strength, said Mary Wareham, one of the report's authors. Stockpile destruction is also one of the Convention on Cluster Munitions' success stories. To date, a total of 36 states' parties have destroyed 99% of all stocks declared. Only 10 states' parties now see a need to retain live cluster munitions for such permitted purposes, the report said. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the 50th anniversary commemorating the great Attica prison uprising 50 years ago. We'll speak with one of the central attorneys involved in it, Michael Deutsch. Michael represented these prisoners for over 20 years. Listen to what he's got to say.
We talk with best-selling author Bruce Levine about his new book, Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary and Fighter for Racial Justice.
This book couldn't be more timely with the fulfillment of the American Revolution.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
September 9 marks the 50th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising and the subsequent massacre by New York State police and prison guards. The rebellion at Attica Prison, a medieval-looking place near Buffalo, New York, began on September 9, 1971 and ended 4 days later with then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller, an aspiring presidential candidate, ordering the massacre. It resulted in the most people ever killed in a civil setting in the history of the USA. The rebellion was inspiring to many around the country and around the world in that it represented a growing movement fighting for human rights for prisoners. Civil rights attorneys, many from the National Lawyers Guild, came from around the country to immediately respond to the massacre. They provided legal representation to inmates who were charged with crimes due to their involvement in the rebellion. Many of the participants, particularly key organizers, were subject to abuse and torture by the prison guards after the rebellion was suppressed. We speak today with attorney Michael Deutsch from the People's Law Office in Chicago. He, along with the late attorney Elizabeth Fink, were the main lawyers for the brothers. He represented several Attica brothers in criminal lawsuits and the brothers in a class action civil rights lawsuit, which lasted over 20 years and settled in 1999 for $12 million. Attorney Michael Deutsch, very glad to have you on Law and Disorder. Welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Michael, how did you get involved in the Attica situation?
Well, after the massacre and the systematic brutality in rehousing the prisoners, the National Lawyers Guild put out a call for lawyers to come to Attica and help. And our office made this commitment that we were going to do that. And first, Jeff Haas and a paralegal, MZZ Webster, came. Actually, Jeff was among the first lawyers that got in after the retaking and the rehousing, and he was able to smuggle out the first statement by the Attica brothers since the rebellion. And actually, one of the prisoners, Dalu, Puerto Rican prisoner who was involved with the Young Lords Party, had put the statement in his cask because his arm was broken, and that's how he smuggled it out, and then Jeff brought it out. And after that, about 2 weeks later, Flint and I came, and Dennis then came, and then Dennis and I decided to just stay there and continue to work and help form Attica Brothers Legal Defense, and also to deal with the situation with the brothers in the lockup. But those who have been designated as leaders, they were put, X's were put on their back, and many of them were brutally beaten and tortured. In fact, the Second Circuit, United States Court of Appeals, the Second Circuit called it an orgy of brutality, and certainly they're not a progressive organization, and we'll learn later how they just destroyed the Attica brothers' rights to recovery in terms of the civil rights suit. So that's how we got involved, and for the next years, you know, I would go back and forth between Chicago and Buffalo, where we were waiting for indictments, because immediately after the massacre and retaking and rehousing, the New York State Organization on Organized Crime, which had just formed the year before, took all their resources and transferred it to investigate the crimes committed by the Attica brothers in the retaking and the 4 days in the yard, and did no investigation of the state police or the prison guards who had carried out the massacre, who had killed on that September 13th 29 prisoners and 10 hostages that were prison guards and civilian employees. They killed their own. They had no plan to retake the prison without shooting everybody. They fired 4,000 live rounds of ammunition in over six minutes. And many of the prisoners who had been shot died because they bled to death. And the reason they bled to death is because after the massacre, not before, because before the massacre, they had brought an ambulance to the prison for each one of the hostages. So they had an individual ambulance for each hostage and did nothing to prepare for medical care for the prisoners. And what they did was they called after the massacre and said, oh, we have a problem here and we need some medical help. And they called Buffalo, which is about 40 minutes away, and they didn't come till 2 hours later. And by that time, 10 prisoners had bled to death. So that's a short story about the beginning of Attica, or the one phase of the Attica resistance.
Whom did you represent? What were they charged with?
Well, I was representing the Black, one of the head of the security rebellion, and during the negotiations, he would escort the observers. There were about 25 people who the prisoners asked to come to the prison to assist them in negotiations. And William Kunstler was one, Louis Steele, who was the president of the Lawyers Guild at that time, Herman Badil, a U.S. congressman, and many other people who were involved. Bobby Seale came, head of the Panther Party, Black Panther Party. And so I was representing Big Black, but I was also one of the staff lawyers and organizers of the Attica Brothers Legal Defense, because ultimately a year later they indicted 63 indictments they brought against all the prisoners and basically charged them with 1,400 felony counts, and half the indictments had a potential of life in prison. So Big Black was involved in the security, so he was charged with kidnapping, and he was also charged with, because he was head of security, three prisoners had been killed in the cell block, and he was charged with a conspiracy with other leaders to kill them. And so he was charged with conspiracy to commit murder and kidnapping.
What were the conditions like at Attica just before the rebellion? I mean, what caused the rebellion?
Well, the conditions were horrible, and for months the prisoners, they formed a group called, they called themselves the Attica Liberation Front, had been negotiating about dealing with these conditions. The medical care was atrocious. They accused the doctors of being Nazis. The parole was arbitrary. The food was terrible, all pork, when many of the brothers couldn't eat. The pay was pennies for working in the metal shop, and essentially there was a lot of censorship of political writings and other things, and it was futile. They wouldn't change. They didn't change. The warden was a Vincent Mancusi, who was known for being brutal and racist, and of course all the guards were white. All the officials in the prison were white, and it was a terrible place. And the reason that the Atticas rebelled, originally it started out as just kind of a riot. And as soon as they got in the yard, 1,200 prisoners came into the yard. They organized themselves. They picked leadership. They had security. They took all the hostages and put them in a circle and had the Muslims guard them and make sure nobody interfered with them or threatened them, and made sure everybody got something to eat over the 4 days and were protected. So rebellion was caused ultimately by the conditions and the failure of the New York officials to deal with those conditions. And when it came down, the real issue was they were negotiating and there was some agreement as to some of the changes and some of the conditions. But the main problem was one of the demands was to get rid of the warden, Mancusi, and also because one of the guards had died in the initial incident that caused the A yard, D yard, where the prisoners ultimately ended up. The door broke and everybody rushed into the D yard. So that was the story in terms of the conditions. That's what caused the Attica.
What could have been done to avoid the mass shootings and the killings?
Oh, there's so many things that could have been done. As Big Black said, I thought they'd just come in and bust a lot of heads, but I had no reason to understand that they were going to come in shooting like they did. There was no reason. The prisoners were not armed. You know, they had some makeshift weapons for hardly anything. The assault force could not have saved the lives of the hostages because there was no way they could have got to them if the prisoners were intent on doing harm to them. But the reality is that they put out this word afterwards that the hostages had their throats cut, and that's why those people on the catwalk who were shot down died. And ultimately it came out, it was a lie, that every hostage was killed by gunshots, and there was no prisoner with their neck split or died as a result of any action by the prisoners. They should have come in. The other thing was they were waiting for 4 days to come in. The state police and the prison guards who got their own personal weapons, brought their own personal weapons and got weapons out of the prison, had been waiting around for 4 days, and all these false rumors were being perpetuated. They said Black had castrated a guard, and all these other rumors about atrocities being committed by the prisoners. So by the time they were ready to go in, they were in a racially heightened state of anger and frustration, and they went in to just kill as many people as they could. They would have went in without any gut firearms. They would have been able to subdue the prisoners without killing 29 prisoners and 10 of their own.
How did the criminal trials go?
The main trial, there were several trials and several acquittals, and the only major conviction was two Native American prisoners who were 21 years old, Charlie Pernasalis and Dacajawea John Hill, who were represented by Bill Kunstler and Ramsey Clark, the former attorney general, and they were convicted and got substantial sentences. But all the other trials were either found not guilty, or ultimately, when there was a movement for amnesty for all the prisoners who were indicted, a lot of political support for them throughout the country, and ultimately they were all given clemency by the new governor, Hugh Carey, and the two Native American brothers had their sentences commuted, so they were eligible to come out right away. So it was a victory in terms of the prisoners not being put in prison longer for what they did not do, or just, you know, asserting their human rights to be treated like, you know, human people.
We're speaking with Michael Deutsch. He was one of the central attorneys in the Attica brothers cases. Michael, please talk about the memorable people that you worked with. I'm thinking about Liz Fink, Frank Big Black Smith, Bill Kunstler.
Yeah, there were some tremendous people that were involved in support for the Attica brothers. Liz Fink was a key person in terms of the civil rights suit, and was also a solid person involved with the Attica brothers' legal defense. Bill Kunstler was, of course, the famous radical lawyer who was the spokesman for the prisoners and very present during all these meetings and organizing with the prisoners. He was like the lawyer for the prisoners. There were so many great brothers. Roger Champin, who was a great jailhouse lawyer, beautiful guy. Richard X. Clark, one wonderful man and very articulate, and I could go on and on. Herbert X. Blyden, a Muslim leader in the prison. Akil Aljunde, who is the main defendant in the main plaintiff in the civil rights suit. Became one of the spokesmen for the Attica brothers. So there were just many brothers that were exceptional. They had come mostly from New York, and they were radicalized in many ways by the organization. Some were members of the Black Panther Party. Some were members of the Elijah Muhammad Muslims, and some were young lords. And they had a consciousness and a gravitas that had brought a lot of political consciousness to the whole Attica situation. They were making demands like passage to a non-imperialist country was one of the demands they made, and they had brought a kind of a radical sensibility to the whole Attica uprising.
After the criminal prosecutions were dealt with, you were involved in a civil class action lawsuit. Tell us about the allegations you made in that lawsuit, and why'd you bring it, and what happened?
Well, our case was essentially one of assault by the head of the state police, or the one in charge of the rebellion, the commissioner of corrections for not dealing with the demands of the prisoners before the rebellion and just ignoring them, basically, against the warden for the torture and denial of medical care, and the assistant warden who was in charge of the rehousing of the prisoners. So those were the main defendants in the case. We brought the case because we wanted to have the brothers who had been, the families of the brothers who had been killed and those who had been tortured and denied human rights, to be able to get some compensation from the state for what they did. And what happened was, originally, the case languished because it was brought by lawyers in New York and they didn't follow up on it. And then finally, the judge sat on a motion to dismiss the civil rights class action civil rights suit for 4 years. You don't start discovery, I'm going to dismiss the case. So Black went to Liz, who was back in New York, and asked her to take over the case, and she contacted me and Dennis and Joe Heath, a lawyer from Syracuse who was very involved, and we agreed to be part of the civil rights suit. So we then returned to Buffalo and prepared for the suit and began a trial in 1991, okay, 20 years after the event. One of the things that was remarkable is the judge, his name was Elfin, John Elfin, in Buffalo, federal judge in Buffalo. He was just out of it in a lot of ways. So when we started to pick a jury, he refused to ask questions about the jurors' opinion about prisoners or whether they had any relations that were worked in prisons or if they knew people that were involved in prisons. He wouldn't ask any questions about prisons. And he was picking these jurors, like, he picked six in like an hour. And we were objecting and objecting, and finally we caucused and decided we're not going to go ahead with this case because he's making a sham out of it. So we told the judge, if you don't change these questions, we're leaving. And it was a very intense confrontation between us and the judge. And the judge backed off, essentially. And in the next scenario, the next group of jurors, he asked these questions. A lot of jurors took themselves off, or they said something that was relevant in terms of their opinion about prisoners. But the first six jurors, he had already picked, and he refused to dismiss them. So when the case came down, we were in trial for 3 months. Another interesting thing was when the jury went out to deliberate, the judge had a planned vacation to the Barbados. So he left. And while the jury's deliberating, he's in Barbados. The jury naturally has questions, so they put up a little contraption on his bench where he would sit normally, and he got on the telephone to answer some questions, and it was a little crazy because it didn't work, and no one could hear him, and he couldn't do anything. So the chief judge ordered him back to Buffalo, and he came back in the middle of the night with dark sunglasses on, and the media were there to film him, and it was like another scandal within a scandal. And then ultimately, the six jurors he picked with his own process hung the jury as to every defendant. They were all hung. They found that the denial of medical care was cruel and unusual punishment, but they didn't hold anyone responsible for it. So the only verdict that we got, which was a result of compromise between the six jurors he picked first and then the next six, which were based on asking proper questions, they hung except for a verdict against Carl Fail, who was the assistant warden, who was in charge of housing the prisoners and supervising their return to their cells. And what they did was they literally brutalized all the prisoners. They stripped them nude. They made them run through a gauntlet of guards swinging clubs, and then crawl on the floor with glass strewn. And then the leadership, people who were involved in negotiations or security or had been outspoken, they put an X on their back, so they got special treatment for and brutalized specially, even taken away and put in isolation units. And then at night they would be pulled out of the cell and beaten up. So he did get a verdict against Carl Fail, which involved his failure to stop the beatings and brutality in the rehousing of the prisoners. So based on our case, it was a class action case, we then had these damage hearings, which were hearings about two representative class members who would then apply to all the class. So one case was for Big Black, this person that suffered maybe the worst type of brutality and torture, and an all-white jury gave him $4.5 million. And then we had another damage hearing for a typical prisoner, one who hadn't been taken out, put an X on their back, just had it run through the gauntlet, and was beaten as he went, was returned to his cell. And the jury gave him $75,000. So he was typical of like 1,000 prisoners. So the jury gave him $75,000. If you times that by 1,000, you get $750 million, plus Black's 4.5. There was a huge verdict, and it was going to be multi-million dollar verdict. And there was a 4 years more delay in trying to resolve the case and get maybe make a settlement, which was basically stalling by the defense attorneys who were paid thousands and thousands of dollars. They were private attorneys getting paid at a very high rate. They weren't attorney generals. They were just, you know, brought there to be paid and to defend and delay the case. So ultimately, there was no settlement. We went to appeal in the Second Circuit. And this goes back to the Second Circuit being a reactionary court. And basically, after all this, they said, oh, there was a problem with the jury verdict forms, and they were ambiguous, and therefore we can't give any value to this, to the verdict of against Fail or the damages ordered by the jury. And you have to go back and start all over, and you might have to do individual claims. And this is like 25, 24 years later, okay? And we were all volunteer lawyers, you know, we were making $50 a week. And we didn't have the resources to go further than that, make 1,200 individual claims and individual trials. So ultimately, the Court of Appeals was somewhat embarrassed and said that a new judge should come in the case and try to resolve it. And after more delay and more hearings, we finally got an agreement because it was $8 million. The whole thing was $12 million. The lawyers got $4 million, which was spread over a bunch of different people.
Michael Deutsch, it's great to be able to talk to you about this. We're coming to an end to our allotted time. I've got one more question for you, Michael. The slogan of the Attica brothers was, Attica is all of us. What does this mean to you?
Well, when you raised that as a possible question, I started to think about that because I really wondered about, Attica doesn't affect all of us, but it impacts all of us. I think they were saying Attica impacts everyone. It impacts the prisoners, obviously. It impacts people who are fighting for justice and human rights. And it also impacts negatively on the whole prison system and those people in the general population that don't care about how prisoners are treated. So Attica impacts all of us. That would be my interpretation of what Attica is all of us means.
Thank you, Michael Deutsch. great to have you on Law and Disorder. There's going to be a number of events in New York City to commemorate the events 50 years ago, and I'm sure you'll be part of that. And we'll check in with you later to talk some more about it. Appreciate your being on Law and Disorder, Michael Deutsch. You take it easy.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The 1861 to 1865 American Civil War and the Reconstruction period, which followed, is considered to be the Second American Revolution. The slave-owning planter class in the South was defeated, at least for a while. Slave labor was abolished, but came back in other forms after Reconstruction was crushed in 1877. The promise of the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal before the law was fulfilled, at least for a while. Pennsylvania Congressman Thaddeus Stevens was the foremost leader in the struggle, even more so than Abraham Lincoln. Stevens helped to bring about the destruction of slavery and was a leader in the effort during the Reconstruction period to make the United States a biracial democracy. This wise and eloquent revolutionary has been vilified and rendered obscure since he died 153 years ago. The distinguished historian Bruce Levine, in his just published biography of Stevens called Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary Fighter for Racial Justice, has secured a place for him alongside his contemporary John Brown in the pantheon of American revolutionary figures. We speak today with Bruce Levine. He's the Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Illinois and the author of four books on the Civil War. Bruce Levine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Bruce, why is the Civil War and Reconstruction that followed it called the Second American Revolution?
Because what it does is overthrows the economic and social order in about half of the country. Slave labor was the basis of the economy, political structure, social relationships, even the culture of the southern states. And by abolishing slavery, those societies were indeed revolutionized. More broadly, the first American Revolution, the War for Independence, began a process of democratic revolution by pulling the land out from under the control of the British Empire and establishing self-government for the region. The Second American Revolution sought to democratize that society further by extending equal rights to all.
Thaddeus Stevens, like Abraham Lincoln, was a very successful lawyer. He was originally from Vermont, but he moved and practiced in Lancaster County in southern Pennsylvania. Then he went to Congress representing the area of Pennsylvania. What political values and morals did he bring with him from rural Vermont? Please talk about the influence of his mother and her Baptist faith.
Vermont had a big impact on Stevens. I'm absolutely convinced. Earlier biographers have paid very little attention to this fact, but Vermont was the most radical of the early states in the Union. It was born in a struggle against the state of New York, which was politically heavily influenced by enormously wealthy landowners in the Hudson and other valleys who owned estates as big as modern counties and whose tenants had few, if any, rights, property rights, political rights, what have you. Vermonters, or what became known as the residents of Vermont, struggled against that control, struggled to own their own small farms, and the state of Vermont that's born of that struggle lives in that political tradition. It is very democratic-minded. It creates for itself one of the most, if not the most, democratic state constitutions. And it is the first state in the Union whose very constitution denounces slavery. So Stevens, who grew up in that atmosphere, he doesn't leave Vermont until it's time to go off to college, is heavily influenced by that. He remembers vividly in years later that his family venerated the most democratic document of the first American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence. The Baptist faith of his parents was a faith born in and prominent in the English Revolution of the 17th century that brought down the English monarchy, and it prized personal conscience, personal decision-making, and community cohesion, placed the good of the community above the good of the individual, and that also influenced Stevens and pushed him in the direction not only of individual rights, but of the importance of the community. His mother deeply imbued him with those values, and his mother lived those values before his eyes.
Lincoln's initial priority wasn't the abolition of slavery, but it was in keeping the Union together after the Southern states seceded. The Civil War commenced when troops from South Carolina fired on a federal fort. The North could not have been won without the participation of former slaves, and Lincoln came to realize that. Approximately one-eighth of the Union Army was made up of these men. What did Stevens do to push Lincoln in this direction?
Stevens began calling upon the Union government to bring black men into its lily-white armies virtually from the very beginning of the war. And Lincoln resisted doing so, as Lincoln resisted so many of the things that Stevens advocated and which Lincoln was eventually compelled to agree with. And Stevens kept up this relentless pressure and helped thereby to increase public opinion in favor of doing so. That is something he did in general across the board with policies that, again, Lincoln initially resisted, but which Thaddeus Stevens made it possible for him eventually to accept precisely by helping to prepare public opinion for them. And just as you say, Lincoln eventually comes to recognize that those like Stevens who had been pushing for the admission of black men into the army were right, and that the war could indeed not be won without that radical change in policy. Others who came to see the same thing included Ulysses Grant.
Bruce, your book is so beautifully written. I wonder whether you could read for us. One of my favorite passages is on page 168. Think you could read that for us, please?
I'll do my best. This is a discussion of the 13th Amendment. Success in the House came some 7 months later. On the afternoon of January 31st, 1865, Thaddeus Stevens rose to conclude the Republican case for abolition. Other House members immediately crowded around to hear his words, while senators, Supreme Court justices, and other highly placed individuals filled the galleries and the lobbies. The House then passed the 13th Amendment in a vote of 119-56. When the result was announced, the chamber's floor and galleries erupted in cheers, tears, and ecstatic shouts of celebration. Months of both arm twisting and bargaining had played their part in that outcome, but so had Republican gains during the 1864 congressional elections, likely changing the minds of some Democratic representatives then sitting about which way the political winds were blowing. The 13th Amendment then went to the state legislatures for approval. For the aging Stevens, Congress's endorsement of a step for which he had been fighting for so long could only have been gratifying. His health was declining, as was apparent to those around him. But, he said, quote, if Providence should spare me a little longer, until the day when the foot of a slave can never again tread upon the soil of the Republic, I shall be content to accept any lot which may await me, end quote. The Ohio Democrat George H. Pendleton accused Republicans in May 1864 of being a, quote, revolutionary, end quote, party, and demanded they acknowledge it, quote, admit you are in a revolution. Admit that you are revolutionists. Admit that you do not desire to restore the old order. Admit that you do not fight to restore the Union. Take the responsibility for that position, end quote. But such a challenge held no terrors for Thaddeus Stevens, who extolled what he called the purifying fires of this revolution and assured his listeners that, quote, revolution it is, end quote. By early December 1865, the states had ratified the new constitutional amendment. Slavery was outlawed throughout the country.
Thank you, Bruce. Bruce, along with Donald Trump, Andrew Johnson is considered the worst president ever inflicted on the American people. He was Lincoln's vice president and ascended to the presidency in 1865 after Lincoln was assassinated and the Civil War had ended. What did Johnson do to obstruct Reconstruction, and how did Stevens respond to that?
From very early after assuming the presidency, Andrew Johnson begins pardoning wholesale the leadership of the now dead Confederacy and restoring to them all their rights except the outright ownership of human beings. The consequence is that as early as the fall of 1865, the states of the dead Confederacy are now acting as though they are full-fledged members of the Union once again. They are electing their own state legislatures and filling them with leaders of the ex-Confederacy, and they are sending Confederate leaders and generals and colonels to the United States House of Representatives and the United States Senate. The Republicans refuse to allow this to occur and block it and begin to try to implement a more severe form of Reconstruction and eventually begin passing civil rights legislation and begin crafting what becomes the 14th Amendment. Andrew Johnson vetoes the civil rights law and tries to veto the 14th Amendment and encourages the southern states to refuse to ratify the 14th Amendment. When Congress places the states of the ex-Confederacy under the ultimate control of Union generals who are charged with protecting the lives and the rights of former slaves as well as of those whites in the South who had been loyal to the Union. Johnson moves to restrict the power of those generals and then begins to replace them one after another with those he considers more liable to be complicit in the white supremacist action of the Southern state leaders. Johnson also tries to blackmail Congress out of its ability to pass laws by declaring that until Congress brings all these states back into full standing, everything they do is legally suspect. And it is upon such grounds that the House of Representatives eventually impeaches Andrew Johnson.
If Stevens would have had his way, what would Reconstruction have looked like?
Well, first of all, he would have denied them the rights of other states. Those states, the states that formed the Confederacy in 1860-61, declare they're out of the Union. Thaddeus Stevens says, fine, they're out of the Union. Let us treat them as such. Let us treat them as what they really are, an enemy alien state. And once we have conquered them, treat them as what they are, in fact, conquered enemy provinces. Let us rule them directly from Washington, as we do all other territories, and let us use that rule to enforce not only the abolition of slavery, but the enactment of equal civil rights, equality before the law, insofar as we restore self-government. Let us require the extension of that suffrage to adult black men, and let us furthermore provide an economic foundation for greater democracy in the South by taking all the estates owned by the slaveholding aristocracy, the richest slave owners, confiscate that land, divide that land into small farms, and distribute it among those whose labor had cultivated that land and made that land profitable in the first place. Meanwhile, let us strip the leadership of the old Confederacy of its rights to vote and its rights to hold political office. And in that way, let us make sure that we reshape the South into genuine egalitarian democracies.
Devin and Nate, because
sure.
We
yeah.
have it's good because it's going to get duplicative, and
yeah,
just and move on to nine.
Okay, great. Bruce, what is meant by reparations, and do you believe Stevens was an early proponent of reparations? Now, reparations are under consideration by many in America.
Well, I understand reparations to mean doing something to compensate slaves and those descended from slaves for the very fact of enslavement, and moreover, for the era of Jim Crow that lasted approximately a century after the end of outright slavery, to do something, to give something that would enable the lifting of this still oppressed portion of the population out of the bottom tier of American society. I think Stevens, although he didn't use these words, was, of course, a proponent of reparations because that's what dividing plantation lands and giving it to the former slaves constituted, an attempt to give back what was taken away in the first place, the result of centuries of unpaid labor by those slaves and their ancestors.
Stevens was not only for enfranchising black males, but he was for other progressive things as well. Bruce, please elaborate on his position on women's suffrage and the rights of Chinese immigrants.
Over the course of his life, Stevens' commitment to democratic causes grows. It is propelled forward not only by his early values, but also by the problems that arise before his eyes in American society. And so he responds by deepening his commitment to democracy. And thus it is that on the eve of the Civil War, Stevens in Lancaster places himself on the side of those arguing in favor of women's right to vote. And at the same time, when members of his own political party, the Republican Party in California, come before the United States Congress asking it to enforce one or another provision that will make life even harder for the impoverished immigrants from China who are reaching the shores of California, Thaddeus Stevens not only refuses to support such measures, but denounces the state of California for its treatment of those immigrants and insists instead that they have every right to come here, that this is supposed to be the land of refuge and freedom, and that California is casting shame upon itself by its conduct toward these residents.
Your book is remarkably timely, given the upsurge of 20 million people led by Black Americans in the streets in June last year. How do you relate Stevens to the current Black Lives Matter movement?
If Thaddeus Stevens were alive today, and if he were ambulatory, which he was not in his last years due to illness, but if he were, he'd have been in the midst of those marches. Thaddeus Stevens, all through his life, fought against racist violence committed against Black people. And that kind of racist violence was eventually key to the process of overturning Reconstruction in the South. In the almost immediate aftermath of the Civil War, white riots against former slaves broke out in one place after another in the former Confederacy, most bloodily in the cities of Memphis and New Orleans. And the rioters, by the way, in both cases, included large numbers of white police. And that is another fact that has been characteristic of the entire era since the end of the Civil War. White police violence directed against Black people, supplemented by white supremacist vigilante violence against white people, against Black people, which we've also seen in the last year or so. So Stevens would have been an active supporter of Black Lives Matter today.
Bruce, how has your book, Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary Fighter for Racial Justice, been received?
Well, Heidi, it's still early. The book has only been in print now for about 2 weeks. I'm happy to say, though, that most initial reactions have been very positive. A number of authors whom I respect deeply and whom have received accolades for their own work have said very kind things about the book, which my publisher has thankfully reprinted on the back of the book. And in the first week or so of sales, about 1,000 copies of the book have been sold in one format or another. So far, the book bids fair to do well and hopefully to influence popular opinion in its own right.
We're coming to the end of our allotted time, but let me just ask you this. What would you like people to take away after they've read your biography of Stevens?
Well, I hope they'll be reminded of a number of things. First of all, how old racism is in this country, how deeply rooted is the oppression and victimization of African Americans in this country, but also through the example of the Civil War and the fight for equality during Reconstruction, what courage and determination can accomplish in struggle against those things. Thaddeus Stevens, I hope, will help inspire people, even more than they already may be, to fight hard and long for the achievement of genuine political and social democracy in the United States.
Bruce Levine, it's been a great pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Your book, Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary, Fighter for Racial Justice, published. We're glad to hear that it's doing so well, and we're grateful to be able to speak with you today. You take it easy.
Thank you so much for having me on, folks. I appreciate it a great deal.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.